This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
William is a senior research fellow for, this is a wonderful title, for University Design, and director of research for the New American University in the Office of the President at Arizona State University. And I'm sure many of you know Arizona State University has been doing some of the most innovative things among American public research universities. William is also an associate research professor, and this is another wonderful title, in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies, and an affiliate scholar in the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes. Before he went to Arizona State University, he was at the University of Southern California. He spent some time at the University of California, Santa Barbara, also at the Getty Research Institute, and he's a consultant for the Getty, and as a consultant for the Getty Conservation Institute and the University of Colorado Boulder. And he got his PhD in history from UCLA. So we're very pleased to have him here today. And I'm very pleased to be having a conversation with him about this book, which you can buy if you want after this, called Designing the New American University. And I learned an enormous amount from this book. I really admire it. And I'm eager to talk to Will about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that.
So I'm going to start out by first letting our you call for a new model of the American research university, and I wonder, for the audience who hasn't read your book yet, if you could describe what that model is of the new American research university.
Yeah. Well, the model is Michael Crow's vision, and it's for an institution that combines highest levels of academic excellence, knowledge, production, discovery, with maximum accessibility and maximum social outcomes. He's likened it to, or it has been likened to, and we've accepted it, to combining UC levels of research excellence with Cal State accessibility in a single institution. One of the main arguments behind this is that research universities, the set of research universities, and there are really only roughly 100 out of 5,000 colleges and universities in the United States, there are only really 108 what the Carnegie Foundation terms RUVH institutions. You may be familiar with the term research extensive, they used to be called. And another second cohort of about 100 institutions that are less research extensive. But these institutions have become increasingly inaccessible. And his vision was that these universities should not be accessible only to the top 5% of American students or 10%, but to the top 25%, and not only socioeconomically disadvantaged students, but students from the middle classes, students who have differing indicators of creativity and intelligence. So it's taking a fairly entrenched model. No one is surprised to hear any longer that Stanford accepted only the top 5% of applicants for their class of 2019. Harvard comes in at about 5%. And Berkeley, something like 7.8%. So the model calls for maximum levels of accessibility to institutions that have academic platforms of knowledge production and discovery.
Mm-hmm. So you feel passionately, as does Michael Crow, about access and the need to increase capacity, really, as you just said. I think you told me at lunch that Arizona State University has 91,000 students. Am I remembering that, right?
That is true, and that's something like a 65% increase since he arrived. So there are 91,000 students. 20,000 of those are enrolled online. Of those 20,000, 4,000 are in the ASU Starbucks program.
Yeah.
That we discussed.
So. Oh, that's what we were talking about.
Right.
That, and I was wondering, I'm sure many of you heard about ASU's offer that any employee of Starbucks could go to ASU free
online.
Of cost, right?
Yes.
Online. But so a 65% increase, I didn't know that figure. That's huge. But since what, did Michael go in 2002?
Since 2002, yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And The implications behind looking at scale and accessibility, scale of institutions, is the public value of an institution is, in a sense, very often determined by the fact that it serves its public adequately. So if the division of motor vehicles served only 100 people a day, but did it very well, and all 100 people were very satisfied, but there were still 3,000 people waiting on the sidewalk at the end of the day who couldn't get in the door, that detracts from its public value. And so it's a matter of size relative to the population that an institution serves. And his argument is that the set of research universities doesn't offer the enrollment capacity. The infrastructure of American higher education was largely developed through the mid-20th century, and there have been no new universities of any scale to speak of, either public or private. this is a complementary model. It's not in any way meant to replace or detract from the accomplishments of the set of American research universities. They're the most sophisticated and complex institutions in the world. And as Jonathan Cole, the provost emeritus at Columbia, who's written a really marvelous book called The Great American University, came out in 2009. Whenever he gives a talk, he begins by explaining or reminding people that research universities have multiple missions, that they're not just institutions where you send your kids to school. I mean, they're responsible for discovery and innovation that's improved the lives of humanity worldwide, that drives economic competitiveness. And so Michael Crow's argument has been that this set of institutions, at least some subset of this set of institutions, should take on the responsibility to expand their enrollment. And so actually very recently, just as we were completing the book, Michael is now chairing something called the University Innovation Alliance. And these are 11 large public research universities that have agreed to take on this mission of attempting to expand enrollment, specifically to socioeconomically disadvantaged or historically underrepresented students. But this includes some AAU institutions like the University of Texas Austin, Ohio State, Oregon State, UC Riverside is part of the alliance. And so this is one outcome of his push to encourage to raise awareness and to encourage research universities to expand their enrollment capacity, which as we were discussing earlier, I mean is a major is a you know significant challenge, of course.
So what are the challenges of doing this? I mean, that almost boggles my mind to think of increasing the size of an institution 67% in little more than a decade. You were there the whole time. What were the most significant challenges in doing that?
That's right. The enrollment growth, I'm just looking at the figures here, reminding myself that the enrollment growth has risen from 55,000 students, undergraduate, graduate, and professional, in 2002 to the 91,557 now. So yeah. that is a 65% increase. So degree production has increased more than 78% mm-hmm. over this 12-year period. So ASU awarded 21,000 degrees during the previous academic year. It's awarded 100,000 degrees during the last six academic years. Each entering freshman cohort contains, even though ASU admits, I was citing those figures for Stanford, 5%, Harvard, 5%, Berkeley, 7.8%. ASU is admitting 80% of applicants. And for some reason, people hear that and they think, well, it's open enrollment. But that's not remotely the case. The academic requirements for these students, these are academically qualified Arizona residents. They're the same as what the University of California, the standards that the University of California had in the 1950s and 1960s. So students who were, John Douglas has written extensively on mm-hmm. this, of course. Students who in California in the 50s and 60s who completed a set of 10 required courses and maintained a 3.0 grade point average were essentially automatically admitted. And so Michael Crow often remarks when he goes around speaking to different groups, business groups around the country, he will tell the CEOs and leaders of these corporations that you would not be admitted to the school where you were a student in the 70s or 80s because the admission standards have risen so to such an unprecedented extent. A number of factors are.
Though there certainly is some element of grade inflation in that too, isn't there?
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
Sure.
But what about, I'm really interested in what the challenges are for the university. I mean, for a moment, yeah. Let's say we all agree this is the single most important thing to do. What are the challenges in actually doing it?
Well, the way what ASU has done is to adopt a much more flexible framework, and to if to admit all qualified students essentially means revamping and refurbishing the existing infrastructure, seeking additional resources from creative collaborations with mm-hmm. with business and industry, governments. Mm-hmm. It has worked at ASU. It wouldn't necessarily work in other municipalities mm-hmm. And in other contexts. But I think the success has shown that it is possible. Now, at the same time that the enrollment growth has increased by 65%. The academic profile of students is all indicators, SAT scores, have increased dramatically as well. The number of academic awards the students receive, the Fulbrights, the Truman Scholars, across the board have increased dramatically as well.
Yeah. But what about, I mean, just when I think of scaling up at that level, I yeah. think of the physical facilities that would be important to build in a pretty short period of time. I think of all the faculty that would need to be hired. How did you handle those challenges in scaling up that fast?
Well, at the same time that the university has scaled up. Through significant investment in research infrastructure, the research expenditures have increased dramatically too, going from by a factor of 3.5, going from 123 million to 425 million mm-hmm. during this period, without a significant increase in the size of the faculty. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer to your question then is that faculty who sign on are willing to take on additional teaching responsibilities. Mm-hmm. That's become part of the promotion and tenure criteria, mm-hmm. as well as public service.
Mm-hmm.
There's far more flexible use of the infrastructure that does exist. I mean, in terms of semesters have been divided up into three-part units, so you have an A, B, and C, mm-hmm. and not all classes are necessarily the full course of the semester. They might mm-hmm. just be 7-week or 14-week mm-hmm. units. Summer school enrollment, and at the same time, the degree production has become dramatically more efficient. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cost has come down per student, so that ASU is actually one of the most efficient producers of degreed students in the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another element of your vision, which is the, you describe variously as transdisciplinarity or interdisciplinarity. You argue that the university as it currently exists has design limitations, and you describe those design limitations as we're too great a fixation on departments as representative of traditional academic disciplines. And in your imagination, yours and Michael Crow's imagination of this new American university, you think things should be far more, the word you keep using is transdisciplinary.
Right.
And could you talk a little bit about your conception of the transdisciplinarity, I guess I would say,
yeah.
and how you achieve that?
Well, I think the distinction that some theorists of interdisciplinary like to make is that transdisciplinarity implies also going outside the institution, collaborations with business, mm-hmm. industry, and government.
Mm-hmm.
This has been one of his objectives from the outset is that there's really no need for disciplines to be departmentally based for this correlation that has existed since that certainly became codified in the 19th century,
yeah, right.
with the emergence of the American Research University out of the its various antecedent institutional types, like most prominently the German Research University, epitomized by the University of Berlin, Wilhelm von Humboldt's vision, and the Oxbridge model. These were Oxford and Cambridge were the, in a sense, the progenitors of the elite colonial colleges, and which became the Ivy League. Now, some of those elite colonial colleges evolved into major research universities, like Harvard. They all are, for the most part. They all evolved. But in the next book that we're working on, we discuss these as the first wave of American higher education. So the schema for that model would be that the first wave are the elite colonial colleges. The second wave were the early regional and state universities. The third wave were the land-grant universities that were established as a consequence of the Morrill Act in 1862. That Abraham Lincoln signed into law during the Civil War. And then the American Research University, the fourth wave, is what is actually pinpointed to the formation of Johns Hopkins in Baltimore in 1876 by the first president of the University of California, Daniel Coit Gilman, who left because of apparently some difficulties with the legislature here. And so Johns Hopkins, in a sense, institutionalized the model of the American Research University. Then, during the period between 1876 and 1915, 15, this is per Roger Geiger. He's a historian of higher education at Penn State. He's sort of written the book on this. 15 institutions, 5 public universities, 5 private, the state flagships like Michigan, California, Berkeley, I mean California, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, and then 5 privates, the Ivy League institutions, and then institutions that were conceived from whole cloth by as a result of philanthropic endowments, Stanford, University of Chicago, the Rockefellers got started that. These institutions all set what Michael Crow terms the gold standard in American higher education. And the fifth wave is what he envisions to be the emergence of the fourth wave institutions into what might be termed super publics. So these are public research universities that take on this mission of enrollment at scale to meet enrollment demand. Now the funny thing is, the first wave institutions like the elite colonial colleges, some of them still exist in that very form. I mean, places like Bard and Bowdoin, they still are very much what they were in the early 19th century. And some of the second wave institutions that were established as second wave, like the University of Virginia, that has evolved into a fourth wave institution. Most of the flagship public universities that were land grants became fourth wave institutions. So this is a vision for the further evolution of the American research university. Because most people assume that the institution has reached it's done. As Michael Crow always says, people just assume it's done, and departments are done, and what more do you need? Part of the transdisciplinarity objective is to also address what are always termed the grand challenges, I mean, societal problems that cannot be addressed only through one discipline. I mean, you have to have people from a dozen different disciplines working on some of these problems, like climate change and poverty and collapse of ecosystems. And some of the transdisciplinary schools that he has established or led the establishment of, because this is very much faculty driven. I mean, this is part of the model too, is that he encourages the faculty to be creative, to self-organize, to form new collaborations and partnerships. So the School of Life Sciences was, before that, 5 or 6 different biology faculties. What was anthropology became the School of Human Evolution and Social Change, which incorporates a lot of other scholars from the social scientists and scholars from the social sciences. The School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies that you remarked on was 3 separate departments, and now they're nominally in one school.
Are the faculty all happy campers about this?
Surprisingly, for the most part, I understand that there are some people that complain, but. For the most part, it has been a real success by all accounts. Mm-hmm. And
do you have a College of Engineering, for example? What about the
what was formerly the College of Engineering? Now, this is interesting. That has become five research intensive schools. So with a gift from Ira Fulton, they're now termed the Ira Fulton Schools of Engineering. And so there's, for example, a School of Sustainability and Sustainable Development, mm-hmm. School of Computing and Informatics. There are actually five different schools that are each interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary. And then for students who don't plan to go to graduate school, but who have every capacity to succeed professionally as engineers, there is on the Polytechnic campus a school that is basically focused on hands-on study of engineering and workforce development. This was even part of the flexible framework that you asked about. Mm-hmm. There are now four campuses, including mm-hmm. the new downtown campus. And they're meant to be clusters of similar schools that work well together. So, for example, the downtown campus is journalism, the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. The law school is moving down there, public policy. Schools that would benefit from access to state and local governments.
And you mean downtown Tempe or downtown Phoenix?
Phoenix.
Oh, mm-hmm. downtown Phoenix.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And light rail connects the campuses. Mm-hmm. The what was formerly just the a campus out, what became a campus that was a former military air base in Mesa, is now the Polytechnic campus, and, mm-hmm. and the objective is to make it competitive with, say, Cal Poly. There's a West campus, and they each have unique clusters of schools, and so that more flexible framework has also allowed for enrollment capacity.
And do the students apply to particular campuses, or do they just apply to ASU and
then they find
their home on a particular campus?
Yes, exactly. That's one of his objectives. One of Michael Crow's objectives was not to have tiered campuses. Mm-hmm. Many satellite campuses are, mm-hmm. Decidedly intended for students who aren't academically qualified to go to the main campus. Mm-hmm. And so here, the degree simply states that it's a degree from Arizona State University. It doesn't mm-hmm. specify a campus.
Yeah. I'm curious about the relationship with the state in all this. Did the state just say, go and do good, do this? Did you have struggles with the state as you were? Because this sounds like a very significant change for ASU, both in its development of its research portfolio, but also in this massive increase in enrollment.
Yes.
Did you run into any obstacles with the state?
Well, I believe that with the assistance of the Board of Regents, mm-hmm. The legislature has generally been persuaded that it's a good thing that the degrees are produced more efficiently, mm-hmm. and so they have generally been supportive, except of course state disinvestment came about as a consequence of the economic downturn, the Great Recession in 2008. So funding was cut by something like 45%. It was the largest, both in terms of percentage and in terms of just dollars, of any university probably in the country.
Yeah, and I guess the president of the University of California was, for part of the period, she was the governor, right, that Michael Crow was dealing with.
That's right.
That they had a working relationship.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ask a question that what you were saying about transdisciplinary really bears on, and this is a question I think about often in relationship to Berkeley, that we say often as just an article of faith that students benefit, undergraduate students benefit, get a unique benefit from going to a research-intensive university better than a non-research, a liberal arts college, the mm-hmm. Bards and the Bates and the Bowdens of the world. Mm-hmm. But I don't know a lot of evidence that shows that that's the case. And I I'm really interested because one of the claims that your book makes, I think very interestingly, is that what you and Michael Crow believe is that these students that you're admitting to ASU deserve and are benefited by getting their education in a research-intensive university. And yet I often think about some of the research-intensive universities that I know with huge student bodies, mm-hmm. that these students are taught many classes by graduate students or adjuncts. They sit in very big lecture classes. That
exactly,
the way in which we imagine research-intensive experiences doesn't necessarily apply to every student that mm-hmm. sets foot on the campus. And I wonder if you could talk about
that a little bit. That's very true. And I'm sure that the educations that students receive in the top liberal arts colleges are just fully the equivalent. But the advantage is possibly that in a research grade environment, students are studying with faculty who are at the cusp of knowledge. They're engaged in the vanguard of knowledge production and innovation. But the statistical evidence, the metrics to back that up, we're still looking for that as well. I mean, certainly the provost's office is measuring outcomes, and we're looking at evidence from elsewhere. I mean, ever since the Boyer report, I suppose, mm-hmm. in 1996, there has been a push for research learning, but. This is possibly somewhat tangential, but Kevin Carey, mm-hmm. who does higher education policy at the New America Foundation, had an interesting article, a column, where he said that when President Obama remarks that the United States has the greatest universities in the world, most people, when they hear that, assume that that means that on average, American universities are the best in the world, and that's not actually the case. If you say that we have the best universities in the world, it's because of the top research universities. Shanghai Jiao Tong University does these ranking of world universities. The methodology is very credible. 17 out of 20 of the world's top universities are American research universities. When the Times Higher Education does their rankings, it's always at least 14 out of 20 or 15 out of 20 are American research universities. But for many average students who have every potential to succeed academically, they don't get to study at the top 50 liberal arts colleges or the top research universities. And so in terms of scale and accessibility, if you take all the students enrolled in the top 50 liberal arts colleges, they would fit inside of Michigan Stadium. So that's Anthony Grafton, the historian Anthony Grafton, pointed this out. That's only 100,000 students out of 21 million students in the United States, 18.2 million undergraduates. So there's 100,000 students enrolled in the top 50 liberal arts colleges, top 50 according to U.S. News and World Report, but we can take that as a proxy for, excellence. And then all the students in the Ivy Leagues, the eight institutions of the Ivy League, could fit inside of Yale Bowl. Mm-hmm. I mean, not quite. There'd be a little overflow, but close for rhetorical effect. Now that's 1% of American students. I mean, and 1% meant to evoke the outrage at the 1% and the 99%. in terms of economic terms. But so the 1% of American students attend the Ivy Leagues and the top 50 liberal arts colleges. If we take all of the top universities that belong to the AAU, which is the Association of American Universities, which are the 60 considered the 60 most prestigious universities in the U.S., that still only brings us to 5% of American students, between 5 and 6%. If you add all of the RUVH, the research extensive institutions, to that, if you add the 108 that weren't counted in the AAUs, that brings us to 10 or 11% of American students. So the argument, the scale and accessibility argument that Michael Crow makes is that we should have that kind of research grade education available to the maybe top 25% of American students, because the future of American innovation depends on it. The Center for the Workforce Education in the Workforce at Georgetown publishes, someone named Anthony Carnevale does a lot of reports on education, higher education and the workforce. They're projecting a shortfall of 3 million college educated workers by 2018. Everything points to the need for more higher education that brings students to competitive levels for the global knowledge economy. And so that's part of the motivation.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you one more question, then I'm going to throw it open to questions from the audience. But the question I have is about the online students. So let's accept for the moment that your argument is right about this research-intensive education for the students you admit. Are the online students getting the same experience? What about your, Starbucks employee who's getting her degree at Arizona State? Do they have the same benefit from the research intensive university?
That's a very good point, and we should address that in the next book more fully. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that the online students do have access to curricula that are prepared by ASU faculty. Certainly, there. I suppose the number of research opportunities would not be the same as for what we term students in the immersive learning environment. Mm-hmm. But insofar as possible, the online students' degree programs are not meant to be diluted in any way.
Mm-hmm. Well, for your questions, yes, Avi.
Much yet, or very little about funding for this great expansion, except to say that there was this enormous cut in funding recently.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what the sources are for funding, and sort of in line with the old Carnegie Foundation issue, who pays, who benefits.
Exactly.
And how this translates into things like the percentage of students who are outside the state, the percentage of tenure track faculty, has that changed in the recent decade, and those kind of related financial issues?
Yeah, no. Well, those are all interrelated, certainly. And what President Crow always points out is that there are 17. Revenue streams. I couldn't name them for you right now, but certainly the expansion of the research infrastructure has increased research-sponsored research funding, going from $123 million to $425 million with the objective of bringing it to $700 million by 2020. Partnerships with business and industry, with local governments, philanthropic support, support from alumni, finding efficiencies where they can be found. The cost of degree production has, as I've mentioned, gone down dramatically. It's a complex challenge, and he thinks of this in terms of the concept of academic enterprise, that in the past, public universities very often viewed themselves as agencies rather than enterprises. They were agencies in the bureaucratic sense of depending on public funding. So like the Division of Motor Vehicles again, routinization, standardization, these were the hallmarks of agencies that saw themselves primarily in the service function of producing undergraduates. And the opposite of that would be academic enterprise. So the university views itself as an enterprise and enters into partnerships and seeks first mover advantages with creative technologies, and so it is actually a model that demonstrably works at ASU.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in the back.
So I'll accept your premise that it's ridiculous that Stanford's accepting 5% of people and that there should be more access to that. But I don't quite understand the logistical model that you're proposing. So let's just take California as an example. You're basically, I think, proposing to increase enrollment at the UCs 3, 4, 5-fold. So basically you're taking people who might be at the CSUs and moving them into the UC system. So why is the proposal to do that as opposed to make the CSUs more research intensive, better in some sense, or if turn CSU campuses into UC campuses, basically?
Well, if that were possible, all of those would be solutions, partial solutions. But I think it's just this is not intended to be a model that all institutions can or should seek to adopt. I mean, it is something that some subset of public research universities should take on, and thus far 11 have, including, you know, as I said, UT Austin and Ohio State. It is a significant logistical challenge, and there might be other solutions as well. This is just one possible model. The idea is that there should be alternative frameworks for higher education, and insofar as possible, they should bring students to competitive levels of of competence in terms of workforce demand, changing workforce demand in the global knowledge economy.
Yes.
I really like your.
Pass it on in a minute. Thank you. First, thanks for coming. Not sure if this is going through, actually. A couple questions. First, I work here at Social Science Matrix, so I would be remiss if I didn't point out that this space that we're all in actually was specifically established to be kind of a center for transdisciplinary work across the social sciences. So this is kind of Berkeley's mini experiment in social science transdisciplinary research here. So just to point that out. Uh-huh. Two quick questions, kind of unrelated. One is, I'm curious to what extent you've attempted to engage the community, namely students, in this vision. In other words, if I were to stop the average ASU student and ask them, what is the new American university, would they be aware of it? Have you attempted through communication to get everybody kind of tapped into this vision, or is it more behind the scenes for the average, you know, member of the community? And second, I'm curious to what extent the administration has been able to maintain remaining centralized as you've had these different campuses, as opposed to, you know, moving toward a more CSU-like network of institutions.
Yeah. Well, to take your second question first. Yes. No. There is no campus level governance. It is the largest public university in the country, governed by a single administration. So the model is not to move to semi-autonomous or autonomous campuses the way the UC system is set up. Or another model that we have looked at very closely is the University of London, which is comprises 19 institutions, some large, some small, University College London being the largest, King's College London, until they left after 100 years, Imperial College London, and then a lot of smaller, more specialized boutique institutions like the School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, smaller institutions that depend on the central governance of what's termed Senate House. And actually, the former president or provost, I believe he was termed, or principal at University College London pointed out that UCL does not depend in any way on the University of London Federation, but the Federation depends on UCL. Mm-hmm. So I became more resonant suddenly. I don't know.
Yes, you did.
Something happened. But and as far as communicating the vision to students, there was from the beginning of the reconceptualization. What in the book is always termed the reconceptualization or the design process was very much meant to be a shared process with input from all levels, all constituencies, faculty, administration, faculty, students, staff, the community, we have a chapter where we talk about design in terms of Herbert Simon, the polymath, Herbert Simon, his concept of the sciences of the artificial. So he talks about the science of the natural being the natural world, but anything that's a human artifact, including language or urban agglomerations or farms or even language itself is an artificial science. But there's no reason why designing an institution can't be as precise and rigorous a process as the scientific research. It's just very often taken for granted that institutions are what they are, and there's very... there's insufficient effort to organize for specific purposes, to organize for research, to organize for greater enrollment capacity, and so on.
Thank you. Hi. Oh, hi. My name is Andrew, and I really like what you're trying to do. And I do have a question about these ideas about faculty teaching cutting-edge research to students. I really like the idea. I was a student at UC Berkeley. I teach here. And one reason why I also came to UC Berkeley is because I wanted to be a part of that. And one thing that I noticed was that a lot of the faculty that I work with right now, a lot of the grad student instructors that I work with, a lot of their syllabi tend to be very static. And they do have a lot of like old knowledge or very canonical knowledge. And I do feel that there has been a lack of innovation. And my question is, like, how would you incentivize faculty to teach this cutting-edge knowledge to students in equitable and accessible ways? Like, would you focus on faculty development programs? Like, what types of mechanisms would you put in place?
That I suppose that would be a serious challenge. I think part of the solution is just encouraging the faculty to regard this as an opportunity to take on this challenge and to, as I said, self-organize and form new collaborative research, innovative collaboration partnerships. And that would be that's a very good question. Yeah.
During this vast period of expansion, what has happened to your student-to-faculty ratio and what has happened to the faculty teaching loads?
Well, the faculty teaching loads have definitely increased, and as I believe that generally that's just considered part of the program, is that if you're willing to be a member of the faculty there, you should be willing to take on additional course load. And as I said, that's part of the promotion and tenure criteria. faculty-student ratio, that's an interesting question, because we've never I'd have to get back to you on that. Mm-hmm. But as you can imagine, a good number of classes are large classes, very large classes, and but the success of students obviously, you know, suggests that there are other ways to do it than to have a 5-to-1 faculty ratio or 14-to-1 or whatever the most elite institutions boast.
Yeah, Sean?
We in Ireland first heard of ASU through the article in Newsweek in 2008, where ASU was announced as this cutting edge with Dublin City University and others. And my question, I've got three short questions for you, but to fill in the background to some of the people here, Dublin City University, as you're still in partnership with, yes, was trying the most radical experiment probably in university education ever. When you were talking about institutional models you were using, the institutional model that kept coming up when we got questions in Parliament was that the university had autonomous statutory responsibilities. That is, the law was that it should be outside the law. Power was actually vested in a single CEO, a president. And the university took a case at the Supreme Court in Ireland asserting its right to summarily dismiss any senior academic without cause. So that's in 2009. Now, we fought and we won, but it made it much harder for us that you were getting all this publicity as this kind of extraordinary, innovative kind of thing. So I've got three short questions. The first is, to what extent have you been influenced by the travail of Herr von Pronczynski at DCU? It ended, as you know, with him going to Scotland under a cloud. The second one is, why not get the corporations to train the students? Why should the taxpayer have to train them, since we're just talking about jobs? Thirdly, the critical 0.1% top students, do you think they're going to be drawn towards your model? So there are the three questions: institutions, corporations paying for this, and finally, the very top students.
Well, okay, we'll begin with the second one then, because the reason why we shouldn't necessarily turn it over to corporations, although in some instances that's a good possibility, but it's the fact that research universities, like liberal arts colleges, offer comprehensive degree programs that include the liberal arts. We mount yet another defense of the liberal arts in the book, because, of course, that's the very first thing that legislators want to cut. Or we don't need a German program. We don't need a program in Chinese. No one would say that anymore. But in the past, I mean, the University of Colorado eliminated its Chinese program when I was an undergraduate there. It's just the mission. It's the mission of research universities and liberal arts colleges to offer this sort of integrated liberal arts curriculum, where you have general education requirements during the first 2 years and more specialized training for the last 2 or 3 years. And corporations can't do that. Now universities could work very much in tandem with corporations. And I think that's something that ASU is exploring.
But am I right in thinking, with respect, very quick follow-up, you did actually get rid of biology as a separate entity, isn't this correct?
Well, the disciplines still exist, but they're all integrated in terms of the School of Life Sciences. So the people who do EPOB or MCDB biology are all working together along with ethicists and engineers and computer science people. This is just more transdisciplinarity. So But yes, I do know that ASU was looking very closely at what Dublin City University was doing, and I'd like to hear more about that.
It ended rather badly, as you probably know.
I've heard. Yeah.
What about the top 1.1%? Third question.
Oh, the top 1%. Would they be? Well, as I mentioned. Every freshman cohort at ASU, if it's 10,000 or 11,000 students, whatever, if we take the top 2,000, their academic profile matches point by point the academic profile of students admitted to Columbia or Cornell or Harvard or Bowdoin, except ASU admits five Bowdoin cohorts. And this is just partly a function too of accessibility. A lot of those students might not be admitted to more highly selective schools that will only admit 5% of applicants.
But you do have an honors college for those top admits.
Absolutely,
don't you?
The Barrett Honors College is very. Very highly ranked. I mean, this is part of what makes such a large university work is that everything is residential learning communities. It's construed as residential learning communities. And there's no reason why size should be a detriment because, for example, the University of Toronto, which is an AAU institution ranked often as one of the top 20 research universities in the world, is larger than ASU. Or was up until this last year, maybe. They're not size and academic excellence are not mutually exclusive.
I have one last question. Yes.
I was just wondering what the cost of attendance was, in terms of this increase in enrollment. How much of that is coming from the actual students that are now enrolling?
Well, because there's the sticker price, but then there's what students actually pay. And Michael Crow believes that an undergraduate education shouldn't cost more than a Toyota Corolla. So even though the tuition has gone up, it's a model. In the past, the model was low tuition, low financial aid. Whereas the cost has increased for students who can afford to pay, that tuition money is set aside, and enables students who would not be able to attend. ASU has a very large proportion of students who are Pell Grant recipients.
So the cost is about $26,000, let's say. Why, as a student, would I want to pay $26,000? When I could just enroll in edX, which is from Harvard and MIT faculty for free.
Right. Well, if the outcomes would work for you, I believe they have what I understand is that most of the students who do succeed through MOOCs through programs like edX are students who already have degrees. Because the levels of persistence are very low, tuition and fees for in-state is actually $10,157. But that's the sticker price that most students don't pay. ASU gave something like $1 billion in financial was able to give something like $1 billion in financial aid out last year. We have something called the President Obama Scholars Program that guarantees that no academically qualified student would be turned away because of lack of financial means. So Michael, President Crow's argument in part is that institutions that pick the cream of the crop of socioeconomically disadvantaged students. I mean, these are laudable efforts, but they don't address the problem of scale adequately. And in many cases, you're simply displacing a middle class or a wealthy student by admitting a low income student because if enrollment capacity doesn't expand. you're not getting more students in there to, you know, become.
I guess I'm just trying to get at the cost of quality. You know, I think the first question was really interesting in terms of just like who pays for this level of efficiency, and being a UC grad myself and also a Harvard grad. I can't say that the same quality of education I received 10 years ago at UC Santa Barbara exists today, but I can probably say that the CEOs in the room, I received the same quality of education at Harvard that they received in the 1600s or better. So I'm just trying to sort of weigh the pros and cons.
The issue is would someone be admitted today who just because of the fact that if only 5% of students are being admitted, I mean many people as I mentioned in the 50s and 60s UC would admit any student who had respectable grades, a 3.0 GPA. And it was practically free. Yeah, exactly. And this is just no longer the case. And so the argument for this new model would be that a certain subset of institutions should admit students who are academically qualified.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for coming.
Let's give Will a hand.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.